Hello and welcome to the Decrypting Crypto Podcast. It's January 12th and this is Off Chain, your weekly recap of the biggest stories in Web3. I'm Matthew House-Barbie and here for our first episode of 2023. I'm back with Austin Knight. How are you doing, Austin? How was your new year? How were your holidays? How's everything?
Oh man, it was awesome, Matt. You know,
missing me a lot, I imagine.
I did miss you. Yeah, you know, I had some good conversations with friends and family that listen into the pod and said that they love our banter. So that was nice.
Excellent. Excellent. Clearly they have a low bar for entertainment. That's good.
Yeah, I know. It's like, oh, really? Wow, you actually listen to this?
Yeah. Oh, you need to get out more. Touch some grass. you know, yeah, actually, I used VR for the first time.
What?
Yeah, I
took you that long.
I don't know why. I think it's just always been one of those things where I was like, yeah, I'm sure I'll enjoy VR. Guess I'll do that one day. And then I just never have. And how crazy is this? Someone sent me as just like a gift, like a Meta Quest 2. As in like, you know, like companies will send you like swag and stuff like that. Like, yeah. This was one of those. I got a fucking VR headset. I was like, what? It came. I was like, I think this is a mistake. I didn't order this unless I was drunk and maybe decided now's the time. Yeah, it was really cool. It was super interesting. What was even more interesting was attaching the VR headset to my three-year-old and just watching her like absolutely losing her mind with both like bizarre excitement and just like amazement as she was in this other world. She could not understand what was happening properly, except for the fact that she was continuously frustrated that she couldn't sit on one of the chairs she was seeing. I was impressed. It's got me excited about Apple's kind of launch. What is it, Q3? The mixed reality ones?
Yep. Yeah, I know. I mean, there's so much speculation around it, and like the, you know, especially to the extent at which it would be tied into Web3 and, you know, metaverse related projects and everything like that. But really interesting stuff happening in the mixed reality space again. Feels like 2016 all over again. I can't believe when I went through my huge, you know, VR push in like 2016 and I had the HTC Vive and everything like that. I set it up at the HubSpot office. I really thought I got you to use it, but I guess not.
I'm like the worst person ever for this. We've known each other, hung out, speak on a weekly basis for years. You're like one of the biggest advocates of VR that I know in the world, and I've never used it. Now I have. So let me introduce you to this amazing thing, VR, Austin. I'll show you one time. It's amazing. Anyway, right, we got a lot to dig into. We're gonna do a little bit of a roundup at the end of like some stories, but we've got two big meaty stories to dig into. Yes, that's right, we're gonna be talking FTX. yes, that's right, we're gonna be talking Digital Currency Group. Let's jump into our first story of the day. Cameron Winklevoss, one of the twins that is opening one of the biggest cans of worms, it seems, right now. He shared the second open letter to Digital Currency Group, which I most commonly refer to as DCG, has some pretty substantial accusations within it. This includes DCG deliberately deceiving their lenders. So DCG owns Genesis. And then Cameron's talking about them deceiving the lenders of troubled crypto lender Genesis, that they committed accounting fraud in several different ways, and that DCG made strategic decisions at the expense of customers and investors to prop up the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, which we'll talk about in just a second. And finally, and most importantly, where a lot of Cameron's dissatisfaction is really being centered around is that DCG CEO Barry Silbert, who he is calling to step down as boss. So how did we get to this? And let's have a little bit of a recap just to dust off some of the New Year cobwebs on this story. So DCG is a parent company to both Grayscale, which runs Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, you may know it as GBTC, and Genesis, which is a retail crypto lending platform. And for context, confusingly, Gemini, not Genesis, Gemini is the crypto exchange that the Winklevoss twins own. They use Genesis for their Earn product. So that's like where you can deposit your ETH for 3% yield or whatever through their platform. They use Genesis. And they make that very clear in the disclosures, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Genesis is in a lot of trouble. They have a massive hole in their balance sheet. We talked about this late last year on the podcast. They haven't filed for bankruptcy, but they've suspended withdrawals from its lending unit since November 16th. And since then, still to this day, it's not like unveiled a plan for how they're going to resume withdrawals. They recently let, I think this was last week, 30% of their staff go. I'm speculating here, but I feel pretty confident. Bankruptcy is probably coming, but it is definitely not confirmed. So that's the Genesis side. Grayscale, which is an important part or an important piece in the puzzle here. This is the company that, again, DCG is the parent company to, runs GBTC. Check out our episode from November 23rd of last year, and I did a really deep dive on the entire mechanics of how Grayscale Bitcoin Trust works. But in short, shares in GBTC are backed one-to-one with real Bitcoin. Well, at least that's kind of the way it functions on like a redemption basis. So the whole of like GBTC is backed by real Bitcoin. It's a way of getting exposure to Bitcoins without actually managing the custody. Very important for institutional investors. More importantly, Grayscale make 2% in fees every year on all of their assets under management. And by the way, that's $11 billion worth of assets under management. It is enormously profitable. This is the DCG like cash cow. Grayscale haven't allowed shares to be redeemed for underlying Bitcoin, nor do they have plans to. Right now, shares actually trade at a massive 38% discount to the net asset value. This has actually improved since December, where it was as low as 48%. We did a bit of a discussion on this on the podcast. So with that context behind us, this is where we can kind of better understand the claims that Cameron Winklevoss is making. So what he's saying is that, one, during the collapse of Three Arrows Capital, remember that? That really wonderful crypto hedge fund? We haven't heard of them in a while. What's their yacht up to, Austin? That's all floating around somewhere, waiting to be repossessed. during the collapse of 3AC, Genesis lost $1.2 billion from the outstanding loan repayments that were due to them. And this was from the eye-watering $2.36 billion that they had loaned 3AC. Just an enormous amount for a single entity like Genesis to be lending out, especially in the terms that they did that. But here's what's important, right? So Genesis lost $1.2 billion. DCG publicly, I mean, so Genesis announced this, that they'd lost $1.2 billion. They didn't hide this. What Digital Currency Group publicly said, though, was that it was going to fill the hole, the $1.2 billion hole in the Genesis balance sheet to make the company whole. What Cameron Winklevoss is saying is it lied. And what he uncovered is that instead, that DCG actually wrote a 10-year promissory note for this amount, and they accounted for this as a current asset valued at $1.1 billion in Genesis's balance sheet. So first of all, that is an utterly ludicrous valuation to put on a balance sheet for a 10-year promissory note. And secondly, it shouldn't be down as a current asset. It's not liquid, nor could it easily be within around like 1 year, right? Like there's a 10-year promissory note. So usually, and what Cameron argues is that it would also be valued around about like a 70, 80% discount maybe. Like generously, he would probably say on a balance sheet, it wouldn't go down as a current asset, but like it would be down as an asset is about 300K. So here we have like some just, at worst, accounting fraud. At best, terrible accounting. But, you know, I think what we're saying here is this is accounting fraud. The second piece, and this is what I think is just most damning. Well, they're both very damning, but I think this is particularly damning. Genesis knowingly engaged in an arrangement with Three Arrows Capital to pull value from its lenders to enrich the wider DCG enterprise. And this is how it worked. Genesis lent huge sums of capital to 3AC with minimal and very questionable collateral being put down. We've heard this story before. Three Arrows then used these funds to buy shares in GBTC, the product that the that Grayscale owns, which is also in the DCG kind of family of companies. Then, after buying shares in GBTC, Three Arrows Capital used their shares that they just purchased to put down as collateral with Genesis to then borrow more funds from Genesis, which, guess what? They used to buy additional shares in GBTC. It's like there's a recursive trade. And they kind of kept looping their collateral to the sum and size of $2.6 billion, right? Now, the effect that this had for Grayscale is it dramatically increased the assets under management of the Bitcoin Trust, right? And what that also meant is that those juicy fees they were earning from it also grew. It was huge. So they get 2% of AUM, right, in fees. As that it kind of grows and grows and grows, what's basically happening is it's kind of like a carry trade where we're just, Genesis is just funneling funds over into the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust. It also meant, as more new shares were being acquired, that this would grow the underlying kind of Bitcoins that Grayscale, and more importantly, as overall as DCG, held, which, very importantly, they have no plans to ever let, well, to date, they've never mentioned that this is happening, that they're going to let Bitcoin Trust shareholders actually redeem for. So we're looping around collateral, we're borrowing, and we're just funneling money from Genesis to Grayscale. Now, at the time when this started, 2021, GBTC shares were trading at a premium to NAV. That is to say that shares in GBTC were valued higher than the price of the underlying Bitcoin. So actually, at this moment in time, this was a winning trade for Genesis. As shares began to trade at a discount to net asset value, they were losing on this trade. And I think what's like been pointed out really well by Cameron in all of this is, you know, it's a zero-sum trade. And where you'll get to is that, you're sharing some of the wins, you're sharing some of the losses. But at the point where Genesis was losing on this trade, they should have been margin calling 3AC. Yet they never did this. So they were just making huge losses and not actually recouping anything. And the key to understanding why that Grayscale never, the key to understanding why they were happy to do this, this was on purpose, this wasn't just negligence, is Grayscale never actually has to offer Bitcoin redemptions on shares. So DCG were happy to just keep this going, growing their BTC position, growing their fees they were generating in the assets under management, without the risk that GBTC would see like a bank run of redemptions and leave them in the red. Genesis, on the other hand, was losing. More importantly, lenders were losing, as it shows with kind of the current situation today. They made the Genesis balance sheet look okay? Because, I mean, the first question you would kind of say is like, well, surely we could see these huge losses. Well, not really, because they were booking all of these loans that they made to Three Arrows Capital as collateralized loans. They're just, it's just not accurate, right? These are like incredibly risky derivatives. And what Cameron argues is they should have been marked as that on the balance sheet. So now we come to today. Now, you know, the chickens are coming home to roost. And I'll kind of quote Cameron here from the open letter, which we'll share. This made the Genesis balance sheet appear healthier than it actually was, fraudulently inducing lenders to continue making loans. I think this is the piece for me where it's just so damning. You know, the Barry and DCG as a whole were happy to kind of keep milking out funds from Genesis and just funneling them into Grayscale to enrich DCG at the expense of their customers. And now they're left with this gaping hole that they have no idea how to fill. And guess who's going to kind of pay the price? Retail. And yeah. So I think we're in this like really, really challenging situation right now. And rightfully so. And I really respect what Cameron Winklevoss has been doing in exposing some of this. But DCG are coming under fire. And hopefully we will see justice served in a way that we're hoping we'll see justice served in FTX as well. But
yeah,
pretty wild times.
It really is, you know, and in some ways it feels like a bit of deja vu, right? Seeing money and assets misappropriated and funneled from, you know, one entity to another, seeing assets used as collateral for a loan and then taking the capital that was loaned and using that as collateral for another loan to, you know, manipulate markets and balance sheets and everything like that. I'm like having these Avi Eisenberg flashbacks. By the way, we have some updates on him that we'll have to share at some point.
Oh, God. How have we not talked about Avi yet?
Yeah.
Yeah, we got it. Let's dig into that next episode. That's going to be a great one.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a familiar story. This isn't new. Turns out that pretty much all of the big names in the crypto space have turned out to be crooks, just focused on enriching themselves, which is less than ideal. And yeah, we're just kind of waiting really for the final blow on Genesis. And it's awful. Do you know one other thing that I'll add that is particularly kind of brutal that I saw is that in the Genesis terms and conditions served by users, they are able to pull back any withdrawals from Genesis that happened 90 days before they halted all of the withdrawals. So those people that actually got all like in the event of a bankruptcy, all those people that were able to get their funds out in time before all of this may actually not be safe from all this. So this this could get real messy.
How would that work? Like, would that just be a legal process that they would have to go through? Or is there, okay.
Yeah, I think
probably
it'd be like,
that wouldn't hold like, up, right? I mean,
I don't know. I don't know enough of the details. I was talking to someone about this and they shared something with me that I need to dig into a little bit more.
Yeah.
I'll share it with you, but I'll try and find out some more information on that. We can update everyone because I know that many people listening may have used Genesis as well, but something to just be aware of, I think. But yeah, would all be part scary. Of like, yeah, the Chapter 11 and the liquidation stuff. But I mean, on this note, right, why don't we jump into the next story? Because this is kind of very relevant, right, to FTX. So we'll wrap up with DCG now. Let's jump into the next story of the day. We've got some big updates on the FTX situation.
Good news, believe it or not. The FTX restructuring team has managed to claw back $5 billion in lost assets.
I thought you were going to tell us, Austin, that we've just woken up and it was all a dream. This is not as good news as... Okay, I'll settle with $5 billion. Fine, let's go. Let's go. I'm still hanging on to the hope this is all a dream.
Yes, it's not nothing. So there is that. So yesterday, there was an FTX bankruptcy hearing that happened in Delaware. This was a pretty anticipated event, right? A lot of speculation was going around about what would happen during this hearing and what kind of information would come out. Senators were getting involved, seemingly trying to block certain names and information from coming out in it. It was a whole mess. And then the hearing happened and there were audio issues. So you can really tell what was going on anyway from the live stream.
That's helpful.
But yeah. But one of the things that did come out was that, yeah, the restructuring team has recovered more than $5 billion in cash, liquid cryptocurrency, and liquid investments and securities. But this also, interestingly, includes, quote, dozens of illiquid cryptocurrency tokens. Adam Landis, which is FTX's lead attorney, was talking about how at the hearing he had mentioned that these illiquid cryptocurrency tokens, their holdings in them are, quote, so large relative to the total supply that our positions cannot be sold without substantially affecting the market for the token. So it sounds like although around $5 billion in lost assets have been recovered, it's not totally clear how much of that could actually be used to really, you know, reimburse customers that were affected by FTX. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, it is a large amount of money. And the team is continuing to undergo this process of clawing back assets. They'll continue to do that going forward. But they've got a lot of work to do because also it came out in the hearing that FTX has identified more than 9 million customer accounts linked to roughly $120 billion in associated transactions. Wow. So they're basically going through this process to determine the value of the positions in those accounts on November 11th for every single customer. And of course, November 11th being, you know, when the collapse really happened. So I don't, you know, it's not totally clear how much money is sort of, you know, left owed and outstanding, but the process is underway to determine that as best as possible. And then, as I mentioned, in parallel, there will be continued efforts to claw back funds that with the goal of eventually dispersing them to customers. But nevertheless, that grand total, it's still unclear. Estimates have been as high as $10 billion outstanding and owed to customers. So we will see where the ultimate number comes in at.
Yeah, gotta hope that some of that is going to come back to the customers. Because I know there was a lot of big creditors that that were on that list that were outside of the customers side of things. So holding out hope for any of you that were impacted by the FTX kind of lockup.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've talked about it over and over again, the personal impact of this. I do think that the assumption has largely been that no money would come back. So I would be really happy to see money sent back to customers. That would almost be a bit of a surprise to me. And I know that that's a terrible thing to say because the expectation should be that people don't just lose their money and we run away with it and, you know, don't pay them back, but we pay institutions back or investors back or whatever it is, right? But if money is dispersed to customers, I really do think that that would be, you know, a bit of a silver lining to, you know, what has otherwise been a pretty gloomy story. But other things came out in the hearing as well. Another thing that was revealed was that Tom Brady, Kevin O'Leary, and Coinbase are among major FTX creditors. Mm. I guess I'm not surprised by Tom Brady and Kevin O'Leary.
No.
Coinbase was a little surprising to me because Coinbase has made such an effort to distance themselves publicly from FTX.
And major competitors too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, I remember like huge tweet threads from Brian Armstrong saying, you know, we have like no real exposure to FTX and everything like that. Yeah. It turns out that Coinbase held over 5 million shares in common and preferred stock in FTX. Wow. That's a lot.
That would be one of the biggest shareholders, right?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, Tom Brady, his holdings were roughly 1.1 million shares in common stock. And Giselle Bündchen, who was his spouse at the time, she had a little under 700,000 shares in common stock. Kevin O'Leary, who, you know, as we all remember, was kind of seemed to be shilling on behalf of SBF after he got his $15 million payment to be their spokesperson. Unheard of amount of money. Incredible. Unbelievable. Good job, Kevin O'Leary.
Yeah. Well done. Well done, Kev.
Yeah. But he had 184,000 shares in common and preferred stock. So, yeah, I mean, Coinbase
he had preferred stock as well.
That's what this said in the hearing. Isn't that wild?
Yeah. Why? Why would he have preferred stock? Interesting.
So his shares were actually held through his investment firm. So we're saying Kevin O'Leary here, but he has an investment entity that was actually the shareholder. So anyway, Coinbase had a huge position. You know, Tom Brady, Giselle Bündchen, Kevin O'Leary all had large positions. Others on the list included Robert Kraft. So he was the CEO of the New England Patriots. BlackRock. Wow, big surprise to see that one on the list. Lightspeed Venture Partners. And they have come up, they've been pretty active in the bankruptcy hearings. I don't know if you've seen any of that, Matt, like them trying to get involved. Definitely upset. Pantera Ventures and the Tezos Foundation. So that's a large list.
Foundation. Wow.
Yeah.
I'm guessing I'm gonna imagine these were early stage investors early on.
That's what I would guess as well.
I imagine that now, hurts the Tezos Foundation though. God knows what
no kidding.
Yeah, what their holdings are, but I can't imagine it's that crazy big. So
I mean, regardless, it's hard to estimate the value of the shares, right? Because FTX wasn't public. I mean, we're talking about 5 million shares in common and preferred stock that Coinbase was holding. But I don't know what that means, you know, in terms of a real dollar value or loss potential or anything like that. But regardless, they are large holdings, as far as a percentage of FTX goes.
I mean, if we did some like dumb estimated math here, right? Like you got to imagine that Tom Brady is a big ambassador, probably took a big chunk of his pay in stock, I would imagine, just thinking about this, because it's like private equity, just even thinking about tax purposes for him. And you got to think he's going to command a serious amount of cash, like tens of millions, you'd probably say, at least for Tom Brady. Yep. So I think it's reasonable to say, like, let's even do like a napkin of this, that those like million shares were worth like, let's say 15 million, something like maybe 20, maybe even more because of just wild valuation that it had. So then for Coinbase to have like 5x that, you're talking like it could be 100 million, could be 200 million, right? Like it starts to get pretty big. I mean, I want to reemphasize, this is me just completely speculating here, but I imagine it's substantial enough from a cap table perspective, maybe not necessarily from like a financial perspective, that's going to hurt them per se.
Yeah. So it's an interesting one to see that come out in the hearings. Also, I think it's, you know, interesting to think about all of the spokespeople that FTX had over, you know, the last couple of years. Steph Curry from the Golden State Warriors was also an ambassador to FTX. Wasn't mentioned as a shareholder or really at all in the hearings. But, you know, there's a long list of people that were involved, and it's unclear what their exposure could have potentially been. So that's a rough one. I mean, I know that there were headlines going around saying that Tom Brady lost like hundreds of millions of dollars in this. I don't know what the end result of that was. That sounded very sensationalized to me. But if that did happen to him, I would feel like, imagine building like the greatest football career of all time and then losing it in FTX. Oh my God.
I imagine he'll do fine. I'm sure he'll land on his feet like he often does.
Yeah. So there were some other cool things, or not cool things, but wild things that came out in the hearing. Matt, I've been so abused over the last couple years that I think
you got Stockholm syndrome. Cool.
Yeah. So another wild thing was that it was revealed that FTX had an office across the street from the White House and the Treasury Department. Yeah.
Excellent.
So this was at 655 15th Street Northwest. And Matt, I've got a map here if you if you can pull it up there. So that red pin there, that is the office. And then if you just look really across
the
street.
You could throw a stone at the White House.
Yep, that's the White House right there.
Yeah. Oh my goodness me.
Yeah, so literally for all of our listeners, this office is, I think, it looks like just about as close as you could possibly get to the White House.
I'd go out on a limb and I'd say that is the literal closest office possible as the crow flies to the White House. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, it's impressive. And so this is actually closer than the Blockchain Association. Their office is a 25-minute drive away. Coin Center's office is a 10-minute drive away. This is like probably a 3-minute walk if they allow you through the gates. If you have to climb the fence, maybe it's like 5 minutes because you'll be sprinting.
what I actually really love about this, like if you actually look at when we look at the map, it's like, okay, it's really close to the White House, but in the offices here of the FTX office, if you looked out the window directly across the road from you, you would be looking at the window into the US Treasury Department. It is literally look like one side of the road, exactly opposite the road. That is the building. It's the Treasury Department. You can't write this stuff. It's unbelievable.
It's incredible.
I imagine SBF, like getting some kind of like zip wire that he just like dives into through the Treasury Department windows to just go unnoticed. Not great. Not good optics, I would say, for Sam.
Yeah, it's wild. So the reason this came out is because they actually had a 6-year lease on this place. And they're trying
on the Treasury Department or?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, depending on your point of view, Matt, that might be true. to be clear, it was a 6-year lease on the office directly across the street from the Treasury Department. Definitely not the Treasury Department. so they're trying to get out of paying for that. So, I mean, this is a common thing to happen in bankruptcy hearings. More interesting things come out of the bankruptcy hearing. One final thing that I wanted to mention here, is that as far as things that came out of the hearings, they have officially put an end to the FTX arena, or the home of the Miami Heat. The building is still there. It will continue to be the home of
Miami Heat. Have had to cease operations completely. No more. Unfortunately, they are relegated to just playing in street basketball courts. That is it. It's over for them.
Yes. Okay. We can all breathe a sigh of relief. The Miami Heat will go on. Okay. And they will keep their arena. However, it will no longer be called the FTX arena because during the hearing, it was revealed that funds for the naming deal came from Alameda Research.
So now is it the Alameda Research Arena? Is that what we're
saying?
Yeah,
that's what it should have been the whole time.
Right, got it, yeah.
So, of course, after this came out, a judge in Florida swiftly removed FTX's naming rights, and they did this in a retroactive motion going all the way back to December. You'll remember, remember, Matt, back when we were talking about how funny it was that, like, a day after FTX collapsed, there were photos on the internet, like, on Twitter going around of them removing the FTX logo from... the roof of the arena.
Swiftly replaced with probably the crypto.com arena very quickly.
Yeah. I imagine. Yeah. Actually, they already have an arena deal as well. So,
Matt Damon
anyway,
will be bringing the sign over to fit it himself, I imagine.
Yes. Oh, Could it get any wilder? So the owners of the Miami Heat Arena, they're now going to start looking for new bidders and partnerships on the building. The show will go on. But this is crazy to think about, because if you recall, this was a 19-year contract for $135 million that was signed in March of 2021. So, gosh, I think we talked about it back at the time. Yeah, This was viewed as, you know, some kind of indication of FTX's success, actually, because it was such a huge amount of money coming out of a 2-year-old company that raised a lot of eyebrows. So it was like, wow, they must be printing money, And actually, back in May of 2021, SBF said in an interview, quote, "It's been a pretty good year for us, to the point where, frankly, we don't need to rely on the other 18 years to have the funds for this." So
great.
That's hard to hear in hindsight. But he was, you know, really talking a big game there. Of course, that contract is gone.
Well, he wasn't wrong. They didn't need to rely on 18 years because, you know, they knew that they wouldn't last that long and that they could just make up magic internet money to fund it in the short term. So
that is true.
Yeah. You cannot say he didn't tell us. He warned us here. Anyway.
And also, technically, Matt, they aren't going to have to worry about the rest of those 18 years because that contract is done.
Yeah. What a savvy bit of business that was. Yeah. Love it.
All right. So one last thing that I wanted to talk about. Everybody has been saying, oh my gosh, this is going to make the best Netflix movie ever. It turns out that there is pretty widespread agreement within Hollywood that this is a big opportunity for films and documentaries. Amazon Prime, Graham Moore, Panoramic, New York Magazine, Vice, XTR, and Decrypt are already independent of each other in production on films and documentaries about the FTX collapse. But of course, most famously, Michael Lewis, remember the guy from The Big Short, Moneyball, Flash Boys? He authored all of those books.
Yeah, I actually read Flash Boys for the first ever time over the holidays. I loved it. I know some people criticize it, like a little, like maybe about some of the accuracies around like high frequency trading, but damn, he's a good writer. The Big Short is just, and Moneyball, fantastic. I've only seen the films of those, in fairness, so like, you know, maybe a little bit sacrilege to say that, but he interestingly is always in the right place at the right time, which
wild. Right?
Wait, is Michael Lewis SBF? And this has just been one giant, or maybe he is all of the characters from his book, and he just has a front that he's using with various people that he frames. He's like a serial frame. Yeah. Sorry, Michael Lewis. I don't mean to slander you like this. Don't sue us, please.
No, I mean, just an incredible author who, yeah, to your point, Matt, seems to know how to be in the right place at the right time. And it turns out he spent 6 months traveling with and interviewing SBF prior to the collapse.
Yeah. So, it's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah.
He must just love it.
It's amazing.
I feel like if Michael Lewis is following you around, it's like an albatross just like over your neck. He is the vulture waiting to pick the bones off your carcass. Yeah.
It's like you would think that at some point SBF would have been like, wait, is it a good thing that the Big Short guy is following me around?
Yeah. Am I Moneyball or am I Flash Boys? Yeah. Where do I sit in here?
So anyway, it actually looks like they're still working together. He visited SBF in prison just recently, actually. So even after the arrest. And it looks like he's been pitching the film and TV rights to his book. Rumor is that he's nearing a deal in the mid 7-figure range with Apple, but Amazon Studios and Netflix have also been in discussions, and the director of The Big Short, Adam McKay, may be involved as well. So I think that the point is some pretty entertaining and interesting documentaries and films are certainly on the horizon. It is going to happen.
Oh yes. And I'm sure we're all going to be fed up of these films by the time they all come out. Anyway, FTX, the saga continues. I'm sure there's going to be a bunch more. Let's jump in and do a quick roundup of a few small-ish kind of additional stories that we can kind of catch everyone up on in the new year. Binance has seen $12 billion withdrawn from its exchange in the past 60 days. Since November, the exchange had around about $60 billion of outflows, and this is investors are getting nervous about holding assets in centralized exchanges. Plus, you know, the questions surrounding Binance's balance sheet. You may remember us talking about this in December, especially coming off the back of FTX. CZ, he claims this is not a material issue. They're fine, but, you know, probably not something that Binance wants to see. And just another sign of kind of the jitteriness that's happened in and around centralized exchange marketplace.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if something were to happen to Binance, it would be really bad for the space. So good to see them continuing to hold on. It is a scary thing to watch, though, I will say.
No doubt.
All right, another interesting thing to talk about. So you've probably heard Coinbase has laid off another 950 people, roughly 20% of their existing staff, in their second round of layoffs. And I know everybody's doing layoffs right now, right? Salesforce announced 7,000 to 8,000. Amazon, Meta, the list goes on.
It's just happening in banking as well. Now, I think with banking expecting kind of interest rates to go down, they're going to get squeezed from the banks still, like, and also trying to like make their trading divisions work because equities are really, the appetite isn't there. I've seen Goldman Sachs, I think they either have or they're about to lay off 3,200. We're going to see more and more of that where whole trading teams are going to get kind of laid off. So yeah, it's happening. It's happening a lot.
Yeah, it is. And so anyway, you know, layoffs are certainly happening. That's almost gotten to a point where it doesn't feel like it's totally news. I think you're right, Matt. It is wild to see, it's spilling its way over into finance and the banking sector with Goldman Sachs and their layoff. And I'm sure that trend will continue. But the reason that I mention the Coinbase layoff is because Brian Armstrong has been talking about it, and he said some interesting things. He said, quote, "The FTX collapse and the resulting contagion has created a black eye for the industry." So here he's kind of pointing the finger toward FTX. I think that's probably fair. I mean, you know, FTX has taken down significant portions of the industry with it, and I can imagine that has had a material impact on Coinbase, you know, separate from any direct exposure that they had, just the impact to the industry. But then he continued to say there's likely more shoes to drop. He says, "We may not have seen the last of it. There will be increased scrutiny on various companies in the space to make sure that they're following the rules. Long term, that's a good thing. But short term, there's still a lot of market fear." So, yeah, I think more pain ahead is kind of the message there. I would say that, you know, in general, in Silicon Valley, in tech, especially in, late stage startups and public companies, the priority has shifted away from growth and toward cash flow, revenue, profit, etc.
100%. It's like, you know, the kind of easy money years that we've just had of the past decade plus were basically growth at all costs. And I mean that literally. As both of us have worked in tech, right? We know how this works, right? The biggest concern, especially on public company level, is not how do we show how much, like, no one cares about how much profit you've made. In fact, one of the most alarming things for a tech company reporting earnings can be that they've made a profit. As insane as that sounds, it's user growth. And if we're getting towards the point of being profitable, it's like, whoa, we need to spend more, right? So, you know, now that's going to change. It is going to change a lot, and it is not going to be growth at all costs. And I think will see that in crypto. And I think for something like a financial service, like exchanges, I'm feeling a lot more comfortable if that's the case. So yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's a good thing.
Yep. Yeah.
NFTs have been on an absolute tear since the start of the year. I think a number of major projects have been building some momentum since the beginning of 2023 and the last week of December. A lot of big projects doing some substantial campaigns, launches, and just really trying to get some momentum. And it's really been happening. I think Bored Apes, Bored Ape Yacht Club have been like through under the guise of Yuga, have been leading the way with their kind of, if you've been following the trial of Jimmy the Monkey narrative that has been seeking to reward holders of multiple Bored Ape Yacht Club universe NFTs. So their Kennel Clubs, Mutant Apes, Bored Apes, and others. And there's these kind of a whole host of affiliated, almost like what we're kind of calling layer two NFT projects, where projects like Mutant Cartel that have been building on top of but are not directly associated with Bored Apes have launched their Mutant Hounds. There's Applied Primate Engineering or Collective, I can't remember. They have their key cards and a whole host of other projects like this. Floor prices from December 20th through to Jan 11th. So over this roughly 2.5-3 week period from the Bored Ape universe, Bored Ape Kennel Club from 6.4 ETH up to 11.4 ETH. Mutant Apes up 14.5 ETH to 19.4 ETH. Bored Apes from either 66 or 67 ETH to 85 ETH floor. Huge, big wins. And it kind of feels like from the start of January, you could pretty much buy any NFT and make money. Definitely not financial advice. I definitely don't think this is going to last, but some short-term relief for NFT traders for sure. And then on top of this, the last kind of piece in all of this is just, I think, related to some of this, where we're seeing a really nice kind of pump in ETH, which obviously is a bit more driven from US inflation and like more hawkishness from the Fed. The Shanghai Ethereum upgrade has been set for March. This includes a whole host of different things, but most notably, this will enable ETH staking unlocks. So for validator nodes, this is set off a huge run on liquid staking derivative tokens, so often referred to as LSDs, just of course. Lido token, just right, this is just past 7 days. So you got Lido, which is probably one of the, well, is by far and away the largest liquid staking platform on ETH, followed by Rocket Pool. You've got Lido's governance tokens up 51% in 7 days. FXS, which is from the Frax ecosystem, up 14%. RPL, which is Rocket Pool, up 21%. Anchor, up 22%. SY's up 28%. They've been on a tear right now, with the thesis kind of behind driving that momentum being that once ETH staking unlocks, people will be able to, the liquid staking market will open up much, much greater, and we'll start to see increased interest in that whole market. And some of these ones like Rocket Pool and Frax have been really growing in market share overall. So it's mainly, I'm kind of calling this out because it's very interesting to just observe some of this as like a trend within the space, but the Shanghai Ethereum upgrade is going to be highly anticipated. That's about it. That's a wrap, so they say. And we will see you again next week. It's been a pleasure, Austin. See you then.
Yep. Talk to you then, Matt.
The contents of the Decrypting Crypto podcast should not be used and are not intended as investment advice. Please do your own due diligence before making any investment, cryptocurrency or otherwise.